No risk it, no biscuit.
Coming from the Arizona desert, presented by SBNation.com. For Arizona Cardinals fans, by Arizona Cardinals fans, with outsider and insider's perspective, this is Revenge of the Birds. Good evening, Arizona Cardinals fans. This is Revenge of the Birds Radio tonight on a Tuesday night. And it's another one of those good Tuesday nights as the Arizona Cardinals played just a couple nights ago. Sunday afternoon, they played the Houston Texans and came away with a 27-24 victory, a game that was closer than probably should have been based on the last few minutes of the game. But we are here to talk about it. I am your host, Jess Roots. I've got Ben on the line. How are you doing tonight, Ben?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're glad to have you on again, as we do every week. And in a moment, we will have Seth Klox on the line as well. If you would like to join in on our conversation tonight, give us a call, 646-478-3787. Again, that's 646-478-3787. And I guess the first order of business that we have is to have us, well, basically go over what we saw on Sunday. The Arizona Cardinals, coming off of their bye, they took care of business. They had a Houston, Texas team that was reeling. They had, and we'd like to welcome Seth on the line as he now joins us. Seth, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, Jess. How are you doing?
Doing great, especially coming off after that win we had on Sunday. And Houston came in as a wounded team after really playing very well against the Indianapolis Colts and having a very convincing lead to start off the game. They fell apart there at the end of the game. And so they were wounded. You could say they were probably a desperate team as they came to Arizona. One of those kind of statistical anomalies in the sense that they have the number one defense overall, however, that they just are very ineffective in the red zone. The Cardinals were able to set the tone early as they first play from scrimmage. John Abraham knocks the ball away from Case Keenum. Matt Shaughnessy picks it up, scoops and scores. They take it over to 7-0 lead. They go into halftime. The Arizona Cardinals actually trailing. And then the second half, things kind of turned around. Their defense is kind of the trademark of the defense this year is, while they weren't playing terribly by any means, they came out in the second half, made adjustments, locked things down. They allowed only 41 yards of offense from the Texans in the second half of the ball game, and were it not for a very late turnover, some call it questionable, other call it mind-boggling, the fumble with a few minutes left in the game by Rashard Mendenhall that gave Houston a short field and they scored a touchdown. But here we are. They came down. They were able to almost run the clock out, and the defense put on the clamps there for a final drive, and they come away with a 27-24 victory, winning their second straight game. And they now sit at 5-4. They are seventh. They are currently one spot out of the playoff races if the season ended today, just behind the San Francisco 49ers. And well, we've got a lot to talk about. First of all, we've got we're going to talk about tonight. We've got the issue of the running backs that continues to be a burning topic among Arizona Cardinals fans. The touches that Andre Ellington is getting, or lack thereof, some might say, the continuing to play Rashard Mendenhall. And I know what we're going to get is we're going to hear Ben, we're going to have Seth. I'm going to do my best to defend the coach's decision, what the coaches are saying. We probably know what's coming. But we'll get that in a second. We're going to talk about Carson Palmer, who had, we'd probably say it, it was his finest game thus far. Talk about the offensive line. Bruce Arians said it was their best game. It was a great game. We saw a reappearance of Andre Roberts, who, after a very, very great showing in week one, reappeared in week 10. And Rob Housler seemed to have come out of that and not with meaningless numbers as he had late in the game against Seattle, but some key plays. The defense does it again. And we're going to talk a little bit about the chances of the playoffs. But so let's kick this off with the talk of Rashard Mendenhall and the running game. And again, Arizona Cardinals fans, if you're interested in joining in the conversation, feel free to interrupt us. Give us a call at 646-478-3787. If you're not close to a phone, you can also send us a tweet at Revenge of Birds or my personal Twitter account at Senor Jess Root. So we'll go ahead and get started with the idea of the running game. And we had Andre Ellington carried the ball 11 times for 55 yards. He had a couple of catches as well. He was targeted two other times. And there were a couple other plays that were designed to go to him where he ended up not getting the throws in his direction. And Rashard Mendenhall carried the ball 13 times with a reception of his own. And so he ended up with 14 touches of the ball in his time in the game. And Ellington had 13 touches and another two attempts and another couple of design. The playing time went where Ellington did get the edge in playing time. I believe he played about 31 snaps to Mendenhall. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I think 26 or 28 snaps for Mendenhall. But Bruce Arians continues to defend the use of Rashard Mendenhall, and his numbers by no means were good. He was 13 carries, 42 yards. He had the costly fumble near the end of the fourth quarter, which allowed Houston to get back within three. And Arians said it was probably, and he was actually on the radio the other day, yesterday, in fact, and on Monday, and Arians said that he's very pleased with the way Rashard played, said it was probably his best game as a Cardinal. Now, Ben and Seth both might have something to say about, well, that is the best he's done, and it's really not good enough. Yeah. So, let's hand this to Seth's been beating this drum. Ben, both of you have been beating this drum since the beginning. Seth, what is this? Is this blind loyalty? Is there any reason that Arians is going to do this, or is he just blowing smoke and we're going to see perhaps Stephon Taylor step in? But is there an upside to keeping Rashard Mendenhall out there? He did in that their final scoring drive. He did have his best two runs. He had three really good runs that really basically were half of the offense he produced. And Arians himself said that on the one reception that he had Rob Housler executed one block in the open field, that Rashard probably would have scored a touchdown. And those were Arians' words. Now, we've kind of heard what you've said before, Seth. What's your take at this point on the Rashard Mendenhall and Andre Ellington playing time, lack of playing time issue?
The first thing is, I mean, everybody knows my opinion that Mendenhall doesn't really even have a purpose on this team. But if he's going to be on this team, and this will probably shock people, but if he's going to be on this team and they're going to play him, he needs to get the carries, because as a runner, and I've talked about this before, he's not a guy that can only get 12 carries, 13 carries and produce. And we've seen that. I mean, that's been his season in a nutshell, basically. He's useless as a runner for, you know, if he's only getting a limited amount of touches. I mean, he's had only two games this entire year over 4 yards per carry, and one of those games was just right at 4 yards per carry. He's never broke 70 yards in a game, and that's just because that's the type of runner he is. He's very much like Beanie Wells in that sense, where he's not going to get a ton of big yards. He's going to basically nickel and dime you down the field and wear a defense down. So if you're going to insist on using him, then use him correctly. if you're going to only run the ball 23 times a game, which is what they run the ball, then he needs to get 20 carries, and that'll be that. But if you insist on having this platoon type thing that they've been having, then it might be time, like we've all said, to free Ellington, give him, you know, 15 to 18 of the carries, let Taylor have the other 5 to 8 carries, and, you know, and then figure it out from there. But Mendenhall is useless as a player. Some people are trying to, you know, say, oh, he does a really good job in pass pro. Well, he's not even pass protecting as much as Ellington is at this point. So then, you know, so that kind of blows that out of the window. So, you know, either use him correctly and let him grind games out and get stronger as the game goes along, like we saw in this game where his best runs came late in the game, or, you know, just sit him on the bench and let the younger guys do this.
Now, before we pass this over to Ben, perhaps a question we could. I think that this season coming in is that that was probably the complete intention that Arians had, giving Mendenhall the bulk of the carries that we would be seeing him with, 20 to 25 touches a game. But it was simply a case of Andre Ellington making himself so valuable that the offense that Arians is having to come up with ways to get him the ball, in which case it's just kind of the dilemma. This is obviously isn't what Arians likes to do with his running backs, as you've shown in your posts over the last several months. Arians is a one-back kind of guy. But when you have the dynamic playmaking of Ellington, it kind of forces his hand to change things a little bit. And but he doesn't go completely the other way simply because apparently the belief in the organization is that his build, at least not yet, is not ready to be an every back type of player. Is there any, in your opinion, is there anything to that argument?
Well, and that's fine. I mean, he doesn't have to be an every back type of player, but you need to get him enough touches to where he's effective. And 13 touches, and I know they attempted 2 additional throws towards him, so 15 targets isn't really where you want to be. You want to be closer to 20. 15 needs to be the number of carries he gets, and then, you know, you want to throw in maybe 5, you know, swing passes or you know, screens or things of that nature. You know, whether he's slight of build or whatever, he actually takes hits well. You never see him take hits in the chest or in the chin, you know, like Mendenhall actually does, where Mendenhall actually takes, you know, hits flush to the body. Ellington always seems to be able to find his way, you know, into not taking the brunt of the blow that he's absorbing. So, you know, if that's their excuse, then, you know, that's on them for not utilizing their players as best they can. And because, you know, like we've said before, Mendenhall's not a guy that you can split touches with. He needs to get the bulk of the carries. And Ellington is a guy that you can, you know, limit his touches, but the more you limit him, the less you're going to get, because he's not going to get the ball enough to make dynamic plays. So, you know, I can see that point, and I do understand it. I don't think it's valid at all, because there's too many runners in this league that are similar in size and stature to Ellington that take a bulk of carries or touches in general and do it, you know, well. And so you're basically kind of taking his game away from yourself.
All right, it's Ben. Your take on Rashard Mendenhall. You ready to pile it on him?
Well, going back to Seth's last point, Arians did say before the game that he wanted to get Ellington around 20 touches. So the intention is there for that. It just didn't happen for whatever reason. And we saw earlier in the season, when the offense was at its lowest, like most stagnant point, Ellington was still effective in limited, you know, just limited doses. he was only touching the ball, probably 10 times a game, and just about every time he got it, he would go for a first down. You could pretty much count on Ellington being the only first down the Cardinals would be able to account for a couple of weeks there. So it's just that obviously he can do more because, you know, we saw him run for 150 yards against Atlanta. So yeah, you definitely want a little bit more out of him if you can get it, if the game plan works out that way. As for Mendenhall, I didn't really think he was running that well. There's a caveat this week because the NFL site had some issues. The coach's film, I think they only uploaded like a quarter and a half of it, so I really didn't get to rewatch the game as closely as I wanted to. But I thought Mendenhall missed a couple holes, especially that third down and one. I was okay with Mendenhall early in the season when he was hitting the hole. You know, he'd get a couple yards and he'd go down. But that was his redeeming quality as a runner. He would get the yards that were there. And this week, I don't think we really saw him doing that. And, you know, that's really the only thing that he brought to the table as a runner. And if he's not even going to be reliable for that, then yeah, like Seth said, I really don't know what what he brings to the team at this point. As for the Arians comments, I'm glad that he defends his players, you know, at least sometimes. He likes throwing the receivers under the bus. But for the most part, he's good to his guys, and I think leadership is a part of it with Mendenhall. He's the veteran of the group, you know. He's probably good in the locker room. He's probably teaching the young kids how to be professionals. So there's that. And if you're going to keep him in that leadership role, you have to keep him on the field. I think if you start taking snaps away from a guy or you just put him on a bench, it's going to be hard to lead by example and I think maintain the respect of your peers, because it's saying, you know, well, this guy's not even good enough to play. Then what good, you know, what can he really teach me?
And so, and I'm gonna say, well, I'll kind of address, now I'm gonna have to wander back towards Sean Church, one of our fine writers at RevengeOfTheBirds.com. And again, Arizona Cardinals fans, if you want to join in the conversation and you are listening to us live, you can give us a call at 646-478-3787. Sean has tasked me to. Apparently, he has a few tweets back earlier in the day about some of the missing lanes, some of the misreads that Mendenhall had. I'm going to hit some of the comments of what Arian said in his radio interview on Monday. And one of the things he said, he played a great game, made his reads, except for the one that third and one, probably was one that stands out to everyone. It was third and one. He just needed to get the 1 yard, and he saw something and decided to bump it outside. Arian said he saw the nose. He saw on the film whatever it was that Mendenhall saw that caused him to make that decision, but that it was the wrong decision based on the situation, as he was trying to go for the home run out the back door, is what he said. Instead of just getting the 1 yard or 2 yards, but in the press box, in fact, it was kind of a running joke with Mendenhall between some of the writers and some of the other media members of Rashard Mendenhall being good for 2 yards, because it seemed to be the trend. And I'll look back at wrote this down of his 13 carries, 1, 2, 3. I guess it didn't seem as much. It seemed like more. There was a time period. But only 3 carries ended up going for 2 yards. But it seemed like 2 yards was in fact, was the one thing that he was doing well. And we were commenting, the one thing we can count on from Rashard Mendenhall is 2 yards. Until 2 yard is what you need, and then you get one. And in which case, the original ruling is that it was a 2 yard. It was third and two, and he went for 1 yard, and then they changed the ruling after the Fitzgerald catch that it was a 9 yard catch or a 7 yard catch, and it was third and one rather than he came zero yard gain. I still have to go back, but one of the things that I'm going to, in a way, defend. I myself, growing up watching football, I am not a football guy. I will admit that I wasn't good enough to even play high school football. In part, that was by choice because I wasn't big enough or fast enough. So I am not a football guy as a student of the game in that sense. So I never played it. However, knowing that, I do and will certainly admit readily, you two probably have more football knowledge than I do. And Bruce Arians certainly knows more football. As they say, he's forgotten more football than I will ever know in my life. And so when a coach is that would defend him that much and that complimentary to a player, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And when it comes to Rashard Mendenhall, I don't see, other than, I can definitely see Andre Ellington getting more carries. I don't have a problem with Mendenhall being the workhorse guy, getting those dirty carries in there where you're just kind of grinding out the yards to begin with. And that kind of seems to be his MO, that he's grinding out the short yard gains until, you know, the defense is wearing out and then he's getting bigger gains late in the game, as opposed to at least what we've seen so far from Stephon Taylor. And I'm going back to the preseason and to the one extended game that he got to play. Stephon Taylor tends to get bigger yards, bigger gains early, and then later in the game, those carries tend to go for less yards. To the point again, Rashard Mendenhall is, and I don't see a problem with going Mendenhall over Taylor. Mendenhall's going to be here 1 year. I don't see him going to be here beyond this season, and they already have a stable of backs behind him in Ellington and Taylor, who, so from what I've seen so far, is Rashard Mendenhall, is a younger version of Mendenhall, and I mean that in the most complimentary way possible, as Mendenhall has accomplished some things, some pretty good things in his career. And so when you have a veteran guy, the only veteran guy that is who really has any field experience between the five running backs they got with Mendenhall and Ellington and Taylor, who's another rookie, and Ryan Williams, who's only got five games, NFL games under his belt because of injuries, and Alphonso Smith. It's great, and I like having a guy like Mendenhall in there. Is Stephon Taylor going to be better? I'm not sure, because what we've seen from him is kind of the same thing. In pass protection, we've seen Mendenhall has a great reputation of being a good blitz pickup. The numbers, and Sean was throwing this out there, was using the Pro Football Focus numbers. In 33 pass protection assignments, he's given up two pressures. Stephon Taylor has had 11 such assignments with zero pressures allowed. And Andre Ellington, I looked up, he has been asked to pass protector to stay back and blitz pick up in 13 attempts and has given up a pair of pressures himself. So at least on some limited numbers, it's hard to look at overall. On the small sample size that Ellington obviously could have a little bit more improvement to make. But I personally like what Rashard Mendenhall offers in terms of he's the vet leader, and he's showing these young runners how to go about business. Aside, I'm not going to excuse the fumble. I understand what Bruce Arians said is, you know, he thought the forward progress was stopped. I can see where he thought that. I didn't think the whistles came very late. And when the whistles blew, I looked back at it several times. The ball was out on the ground when the whistle blew. So I'm not going to excuse him for that. I'm going to also credit Houston for being relentless on that. And so I'm going to defend Arians in this. I don't see a huge upside from Taylor being in the game, and it gives you that veteran leadership, perhaps an edge in pass protection. And the citing that, by, of course, that we've seen Mendenhall get stronger later in games, even when he's not getting 20 touches. He does improve his carries well. Taylor, at least in the small sample size, does the opposite. Bigger games early and then shorter no-gain efforts later on.
I picked a comment out of some of the conversation on Revenge of the Birds from Uptown 602. He said Wolfley was on the radio, and he said that often the last person to see that they're not the player they used to be is the player himself, and I think that applies to Mendenhall. Like, someone tell him to just stop bouncing runs outside. It doesn't work. Just don't do it.
Well, and there's an article floating around the internet that I read a long time ago. This is probably 3 years ago. That highlighted that's what Mendenhall did on a game-to-game basis, and then I went back and watched it for myself and took notes on it, and that is one of the things that he's prone to do is, you know, he's one of those guys that tries to hit a home run on every play, and you know, just based on wear and tear and the injuries he's had, unfortunately, in earlier in his career, it looks like his legs are dead. I mean, it just looks like there's no burst to what he's doing anymore. Everything just looks at the same speed, you know, and you know, you were kind of commenting about Taylor. That's one of the criticisms Taylor had as a runner coming out, is that everything's the same speed. There's no burst. There's no top-end speed for Taylor. And I think that's kind of where Mendenhall's at now as a runner, is that he doesn't know how to deal with that, and so it's been difficult for him. And he, you know, obviously hasn't adjusted his running style because he's picking up 3 yards per carry basically all the time. So it's just one of those things that it's unfortunate, but it's also one of those things that it's the reality of, you know, the NFL, that you're in the league 5 or 6 years and, you know, you're only 25 years old and you're basically shot, or you're not the player you used to be. And so, you know, like Ben said, he probably doesn't realize it. He's probably realizing it now and saying, wow, I can't get to that hole anymore. That's what's going on. But, you know, he'll figure it out next year on a different team, hopefully.
Well, and I completely see this as in a case where you've got a choice between young legs and older legs that you can use to get the same production, and they're using up the legs that they're not going to be using years to come, while they are picking and choosing the hits and the reps for Taylor, saving those bullets, getting him kind of acclimated to the longer NFL season before they use him on a more regular basis, I think, next year. And I kind of like that approach. If you're going to get the same type of production overall, is okay, well, we're going to have Taylor here long term, let's get him a few hits, a few bullets, you know, get him into live action now, but we're going to save his bullets for when they're going to be more effective. When Rashard, hey, the gun's almost empty, let's empty the clip.
Yeah, that'd just be one of those things that, like you said, it's, they're basically running Rashard into the ground, but it's only happening on 12 carries, and that's unexpected compared to what, you know, you see with running backs in general. So it's just an odd situation altogether.
Well, we've talked a bit about Mendenhall here. Let's move on to Carson Palmer. Carson Palmer, by the numbers, he was 20 of 32. What was it, 240 some odd yards passing, 2 touchdowns. He had the touchdown pass to Rob Housley, the touchdown pass to Andre Roberts. He did throw the one interception, but a QB radio is quite effective. The over his last two games, he has been a far more effective quarterback, and we can point to several things. We can point to several things for that. One, obviously, he's got several weeks under his belt with the offense. They seem to be adjusting things a little bit. And if you look at the two games that he was successful, they have been running the ball more. They attempted, we're going to take the two kneel downs out. They ran the ball, actual real running attempts, 27 running attempts against the Texans. And it was 30 carries overall against Atlanta. And you go with, okay, it was 27. They had the kneel downs as well. So essentially, they're averaging between 25 and 30 carries over the last two ball games. And oddly enough, those happen to be Palmer's two best games. The turnover's still there. The throw to Housler was not great. Arians, in a different case, Arians did point out that Housler could have done a better job of knocking the ball away. But he did talk about the ball placement. The ball placement is placed outside. That interception is not going to be made. And he was complimentary to DJ Swearinger, who made the catch. But that the ball placement that was on Palmer, that play, in fact, was one of the design plays for Ellington to get him out in space. And when the look wasn't there, Ellington was the first read on that. And when it wasn't there, that Palmer went for the play down the field with Housler. Just interesting tidbit with that. So, as we look at Palmer's game, Do you think that he's turned a corner? Do you think is it that the offense has turned the corner? And are we going to see more of week 8, week 10 Carson Palmer in the weeks to come? Or are we going to see a mix in of the Carson Palmer we saw for the first 7 weeks of the season, which aside from week 1 has been a subpar and disappointing Carson Palmer, although we do look at it in the lens of a 2012 performance in which anything that a quarterback can do that is anything positive, and we think it's better. And so we forget that it really isn't quite up to snuff. But let's go with you, Ben, first. Do you think the Palmer's turned a corner? Do you think that are we going to see more of this, or is it the result of the running game? What is this a product of? Is it more pulse? If you had to weight it, how much of it is on Palmer's improvement, being comfortable with the offense? How much of it is the offensive line? How much is it the running game? And how much is the coaching changing things?
Well, I'm willing to say that it was his best game of the season. I'll definitely go that far. I mean, he only has 3 games on the season so far where he's thrown more touchdowns than interceptions. So there aren't a lot of there aren't a lot of performances to choose from there. You look at St. Louis, that could have been the one, but they had the ball a couple times on offense towards the end of the game, and they weren't able to drive the ball down the field and win it. And then, of course, Atlanta has the defense that's comparable to a moist toilet without the antibacterial properties, so that doesn't really say a whole lot, I don't think. But the Texans, it was the best defense they've come up against and actually, you know, played well against. So I'm happy about that. He didn't need a dazzling fourth quarter comeback or whatever, but that's because he actually played pretty well throughout the game, and you know, we weren't in a hole. We just had to hand the ball off and protect it, basically. As far as turning a corner, I'm not prepared to say that yet. No, he still, I think, made a lot of the same mistakes. And again, without getting to watch the more detailed film, I can't say for sure, and, you know, I didn't play quarterback, I don't know, but he's still underthrowing things. It still looks like he's locking onto his receivers. He did do a better job protecting the ball. He actually threw it away a couple times, which is nice to see, and that's just what they need him to do, is just be a little bit more careful with the ball, and I think for the most part he was this game. Even on his one interception, it was at least a good decision, I thought. You know, it was single coverage, deep down the field, I believe. So that's not, you don't really, you're not really mad at him for making that throw. You just wish that the throw was better, or that, you know, House had done a little bit better of a job, or whoever you're going to blame for that. But as far as turning a corner, it's possible that at the end of the season, we will look back at this stretch of games, or this game specifically, and say that, you know, okay, statistically, yeah, this is where it all started to turn around. But I'm not ready to predict that yet. He still has a couple of things to clean up on, I think, before we really see, you know, he needs to do this consistently. And he hasn't done that yet, obviously. It's just been a couple of games where he's played well. So we'll see. It could be something to build on, and you hope that it is. But I think we're probably going to have a couple more stinkers in there before this is all said and done.
Seth, what's your take?
You know, the change in the offensive, I don't want to say scheme, but maybe philosophy or offensive play calling has been important. They've only gone into like the deep part of the field. They've actually cut down on that the last 2 games, which I think has made things a little bit easier on the offensive line. You saw it against the Texans. They only threw 3 deep balls total. The one interception has been spoke about, that, you know, gets blamed on Hausler, and then the one completion down the middle of the field that he had. But even in that, they're kind of taking away a lot of the intermediate game. You look at, he only threw the intermediate route 10 times in the game. So, of his 30 passes, only 10 of those went 10 or, you know, between 10 and 19 yards in the air. So they're doing a lot more stuff near the line of scrimmage and in that 0 to 10 yard range. So I think that's kind of playing to what Palmer is now. We talked about it, I think, I don't remember what week it was, but we talked about it, and you can see that the deep ball arm strength isn't there anymore. You know, that's just, I just think that's kind of been obvious. He's underthrown a lot of balls this year. Even the Andre Roberts touchdown, he underthrew. I know he got hit as he was releasing the ball, but, you know, go back and watch the play, and Roberts actually has to stop at the 1 yard line and wait for the ball to get there before he actually goes. And funny enough, it looked like it hit Roberts in the face mask as opposed to him catching it with his hands, because Andre Roberts drops balls for no apparent reason whatsoever. But, you know, it's just, I think it's playing more to, you know, everybody's strength. The offensive line is not good at holding blocks. So let's not run deep routes. Let's get the ball out quickly. Let Carson Palmer not have to sit there and think about things. And I think it's been working better. I mean, you look at it in terms of, you know, all the different statistics or quarterback rankings throughout the, you know, wide internet world. And he's right in the middle of the pack in the last two games versus before that he was in the rookie range, which is, you know, for a guy that's a you know, 10 or 11 year starter, that's really not where you want to be. So I think he's played better. I think the offense as a whole has turned a corner, and that's simply because, like I said, Arians kind of not switched his philosophy, but, you know, kind of has changed his scheming and allowed, you know, he's kind of said, okay, I can't get the ball deep because I just don't have the team for it. So let me at least get the ball out quickly and get the ball in my playmaker's hands and let them, you know, let them do their thing. And that's, you know, an improvement. So.
Well, and
just about every. Go ahead, Jess.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just about every game this season, I think the Cardinals have come out in the third quarter after halftime, and they made the adjustment to start running the ball and actually commit to it a little bit better. And the offense in general has just, you know, at that point it takes off a little bit. It starts moving a little bit better. And I think that's they're doing that a little bit better earlier in the first half now, and I think that's one of the things that's probably helping just move things along.
And there's a couple of things that I've been impressed with what Palmer does. He does spread the ball around nicely, and that has been pretty good. So you have like 9 receivers who touch the ball. You get Jim Drake at catching a pass or two. You get Hausler. You get Jerome Brown. Now, part of that was due to injury, so people were in and out of the lineup. I do like that he is willing to move the ball around and spread it around. But I think the biggest change, more than anything, that has made him better is the running game. And for some reason, they can't aside from the Atlanta game, they just can't seem to get the running game going consistently in the first half. Although they've been doing a better job over the past two games of at least trying to do it, and the grit, and with the running game, they're able to run more play action. They're able to do the things, and so it just makes things a little bit better. And I think that's probably been if there's one deciding factor in the uptick in the offensive production and the play of Carson Palmer, it's been that running game. They've been able to, I mean, the number of running attempts has just dramatically increased. I mean, again, 30 against, again, those are, we'll go adjusted running attempts. You had 27 in both against Houston and Atlanta. That's no surprise and no coincidence at all that those are the two most, the two best games that statistically that Carson Palmer has. And I'm going to bump back it to the box score of Houston. I'm sorry, the week one, if you look at the running attempts there, and what do you see in week one? They ran the ball 26 times. So you see three games where Palmer has played his best, and in each and every one, they've run the ball over 25 times. That's the key. You're still going to see that. We looked at the anomaly of his 18 pass attempts against Atlanta and talked about, well, is he Alex Smith? Should he be Alex Smith? We're not going to see that, especially in Arians passing. But if he's getting it to around 30 pass attempts, right in the low 30s, we're not creeping up into the 40s, upper 40s, or even the 50s, which can happen. Keep his passing attempts into the low 30s and the running attempts into at least 25, and I think we've got the recipe. If they're able to run the ball 25-plus times, that means they're going to be successful, and that means they're going to be putting themselves in a good position because we know how good the defense has been. I think that running game, especially that they have committed more running responsibility to Andre Ellington. They have not given him majority, as we already know, but because they have two backs that they're trying to get the ball to, because Ellington, they want to get the ball in his hands, and they know they need to get the ball in Rashard's hands for him to be effective at all, we're going to continue to see that. I think it's going to be good things for the offense, personally. The other part, the offensive line. Arian said it was their best game against Houston. And again, listeners, if you're listening live, you'd like to chime in, you could give us a call at 646-478-3787. This is Revenge of the Birds Radio on Blog Talk Radio through revengeofthebirds.com and SB Nation, one of the many network of sites of SB Nation, Revenge of the Birds being for the Arizona Cardinals. Seth, I'm talking about the offensive line. Would you say that the line played well? Obviously, the statistics are there. Only one sack allowed, just the one sack fumble by J.J. Watt. And in fact, Arians pointed out Bradley Sowell, his play. He pointed out that Paul Fanica's game was probably the finest that he had all season. And he singled out Lyle Sendline as being outstanding all year. Would you say that the offensive line play has been better? Well, better overall, and would you even say that it was the best performance against Houston?
Yeah, it was a good performance. I think last games was better, but that was also because they were going up against, you know, a worse opponent. So from a perspective of, you know, playing up to the level that you were against, I would agree with that. I think it was their best performance. Sal stills, you know, he played well in pass protection. He gave up the one sack. What he has done and what, you know, I think Ben and I both talked about in our, you know, kind of breakdowns of Sal. Ben did it from the perspective of his play with the Colts, and I looked at his tape from his Mississippi days. Is he's okay in pass blocking, and he is really good in space where he can just kind of be a, you know, pick type player and doesn't really have to drive block anybody anywhere. But he's still struggling in the run block game. I mean, that is one thing. And you knew that was going to happen when it came to, you know, losing a guy like Levi Brown, who, despite all of his faults, was one of the better run-blocking left tackles in the NFL. So it makes, you know, he's still not great, but it's definitely been nice to see him play better. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're going to more 3- and 5-step drops instead of 5- and 7-step drops, and we're seeing a lot more short routes. We're seeing a lot more movement. So, you know, like I said, you're seeing more screen passes, you're seeing more dump offs, you're seeing things where they're allowing Sol to get out in space and move, which is what his strength is, as opposed to being in the phone booth of the tackle box and trying to, you know, root people out, like, which was Levi's strength. So, but yeah, overall the offensive line played really well. Outside of Winston, who continues to be terrible. And I don't know why Bobby Massey doesn't get any time, but that's neither here nor there.
that is a good question, especially after and I'm talking about the whole Massey-Winston thing. Is really interesting is that they made it a point to get him snaps, to get him time on the field against Atlanta, or they kind of went with the platoon or the splitting time, and he got himself, and he played well. He did his job. The quote that he gave that he got razzed for by backup Mike Gibson is that he said he balled out and he was given a really hard time by Mike Gibson, but he changed that to say that he did his job, he did what he was supposed to do, and the mental errors went down. And it was interesting because then he got one snap. He came in as a tackle eligible for one play against Houston. So I was I wonder if that was just more, okay, let's get a little film on him. I'm not quite sure what that strategy was in that game. But interesting stat that came out is that according to the numbers, according to Pro Football Focus, the Cardinals' offensive line, when it comes to pass protection, is still the worst in the league, having allowed 143 pass disruptions, one more than the next worst team. But still, while they're not giving up nearly the sacks that they did last season, they are. That's in part because the personnel is a little bit better. Carson Palmer gets the ball away much quicker, but we still see a line that is by all the worst pass protecting line in the league. We could probably make that case based on that metric. Ben, what's your take on the offensive line? Do you see it? Was there playing? And looking at the numbers, if you look at the pass protection numbers, that the game against Houston was not their best. There, if you look at the pass protection, granted, it was only 18 pass attempts. Palmer was sacked, so there were only 6 disruptions against Atlanta, and in part that was, okay, there were less passing attempts. So go ahead, your turn, Ben. I'm talking over you.
No, I'm with Seth on this. I think Atlanta was probably their best game overall, and like he said, it was level of competition there. Their defensive front isn't even remotely comparable to what Houston is working with, or to some of the other teams that we've played. I mean, we've played a lot of really good defensive lines throughout the whole season, Detroit, Carolina, really everybody in the NFC West. So, but it's good to see them as a unit having a good game, and then and individually everybody is kind of stepping up. Winston, my comments lead me to Winston, too, because my problem with them really from this week was the penalties. 3 false starts is bad, you know, that's bad enough, but then to have 3 false starts at home is just ridiculous. And then 2 of them being on Winston, I look at that, and I think that's a hole right now. He's been pretty average, you know, at best, but he's definitely had a couple rough games. And I think with Massey, I think he's probably the best tackle on the team, and he's been inactive all season or on the bench all season, you know. So I understand in training camp he had trouble with the mental errors, but at this point, he's gotten some game time. You know, I think he'd be on the same page with the rest of the offense. I think he'd be caught up with the scheme. So that's one change I'd like to see.
And moving on with the offensive lineup, we could definitely say the needs. But the 2 players that were kind of the theme, or if we have to do it with storyline, as storylines were developing and then you see things from the media side, is that Andre Roberts and Rob Housler were kind of the stories of the game. Obviously, Housler picked up his first NFL touchdown on actually a really well-designed play on that screen that not only did he effectively do, but he also did some good running after the catch to do that. And the numbers were, they were the 2 leading receivers for the Cardinals. Roberts with 5 catches for 72 yards, including his 19-yard touchdown reception. Late in the game, in the fourth quarter, Rob Housler had 4 catches for 57 yards with a touchdown. And the question is with these 2 players, is this something that we're going to be able to count on again? Was this simply a product of, at least on Robert's case, a product of being placed in Michael Floyd's spot, where the production will come from somewhere else? And what is it? What finally did it for Housler? I look at this and say, I don't think with Roberts we can look at him and say, we're going to be able to expect this. We saw he started the season last year really strongly. He ended 2011 very well. But he's shown to be, while he has flashes and he looked great in week 1, he's wildly inconsistent. He disappears. He's kind of like his rookie year and also in the first part of 2011, it's like he's on the field, but no one knows it. And so he can really is a couple of things. He's really tough. He's made some good catches, but then he has some drops that will just make you go scratch your head. And there's one other thing, as opposed to take like a Michael Floyd or a Larry Fitzgerald, where you can count on them to make a really big catch in traffic. Yeah, look at the one of the passes in the end zone to Roberts that he failed to haul in. That was a tough play, but you really rarely see him haul in tough passes over his head to come over that. It's almost like he's not made for that. He does a little bit more in the open field. The touchdown was good. He on a double move. And then Hausler, can we count on it? We really don't have to count on any sort of production from him. But I think the addition of Jake Ballard is really going to open things up, whether it's called lighting a fire under him because he knows, oh, I'm no longer the most talented guy out there. Ballard's proved it before, has proven it before on the field. And simply because he brings with Ballard's on the field, the defense will have to account for him, assuming that Ballard could stay healthy, because Ballard is that bigger body tight end who can block, and that he can get down the field, and doing that will only help Rob Hausler. And the fact that they simply played more tight ends out of the chart, I haven't gone back and looked at it very detailed, but for my charting during the game, there was only one offensive play when they didn't have a tight end on the field, and that was it. They were looking at using the tight ends more. Ben, in your case, you think we can count on Roberts and Hausler producing like they did last game again consistently? I personally don't think we're going to be able to count on that simply because if Floyd comes back, Roberts kind of goes back to a quiet number three.
Yeah, with Roberts especially, you know, we get that as the third receiver, his reps are going to be limited just by the two tight end sets and the different things that Arians likes to run, and that's fine. He was a solid contributor for us last year, and like you said, he's flashed at times, he's shown some good things, but he's been inconsistent, especially this year. Really, except for two games, he's really actually struggled. You know, he's not exactly making a case to be re-signed, I don't think, but it was nice to see him step up and at least do the things that they needed to do today as the second wide receiver. I think Hausler, is it a coincidence that the Cardinals finally signed a real tight end and he has his best game of probably his career? I don't think it's a coincidence, but I will give him some credit, though. To me, he's probably been the most improved player, I think, on the team to this point, and it's not... He probably also had the farthest to go, you know, those first couple of games. He just looked lost. He was out of it. He should not have been on the football field at all. But he turned those couple of games into a couple of quiet performances. He was solid, you know, it really wasn't anything to complain about. And then he finally scored his first touchdown today. So it's been baby steps with him this season. But you know, he's not a star, but he's coming along and he's turning it into a solid season, I think. With both he and Roberts, it's really up to them, because you know, Arians loves the tight ends, and if you're not producing, he's probably gonna get replaced. And with Roberts, he's in the last year of his rookie deal, I believe. So it's up to them to kind of use the second half of this season to prove that they belong not only with the Cardinals but in the NFL at all. So we'll see.
What do you say, Seth? Did we just lose you, Seth?
Oh, sorry. I forgot to unmute my microphone. you know, you can say... I don't like to sound negative, but the reality of the situation is you can't count on guys that haven't done it week to week. So until it's a consistent thing week to week, I don't think we can count on them. I think we can be excited that maybe they're trending in the right direction. But to count on them, you know, as inconsistent as even Palmer has been, it's hard to be able to say, yeah, okay, you know, Hausler, it's click for Hausler. Roberts is going to, you know, be that dynamic third receiver, and Ballard's going to offer enough, you know, kind of safety valve help to really put them over the top. When in reality, like you said, this is probably Hausler's best game of his career, or you know, second best, and that's 3 years worth of football. So you know, it's not necessarily saying a lot of good things about that. So you know, maybe I'm at the point where I don't want to buy in because I've been bitten too many times. But I do it for the rest of the season, and then maybe I can believe the hype.
Question for both of you, and I think I've been on the record of saying this before. Odds that Andre Roberts comes back, I think, is almost – I think there's a 99% chance he is no longer with the team. I don't see really any scenario in which he returns. But, Seth, do you think there's any scenario in which Roberts comes back next year?
You know, no, and I was asked this today on Twitter by a Raiders fan who's just kind of putting together a list of free agents or potential free agents, and I said no, and I'll put it with the caveat that if he does come back, then it'd be after they have moved Larry Fitzgerald, and that's obviously if they move Larry Fitzgerald, but you can't have three wide receivers on your roster eating up that much cap space. Especially with no matter how improved Roberts is, or you know, even over the last seven games, or including this one, eight games of the season, you just can't pay that a position that much. And there are guys that will come in the draft in the fifth and sixth round that will do the same thing. So I just don't think they can.
Ben, your thoughts? What's the chance that Roberts comes back next year?
I kind of doubt it as well, but I don't know. I don't think he's going to have a prohibitive contract, because he's been inconsistent and his production's been so up and down. I think he'll be relatively cheap wherever he goes. The Cardinals, they're going to have an issue there with depth, because if Roberts does go, suddenly, Jerron Brown, undrafted, like eight catches in his career, is your third receiver, and then if something happens to Fitz or Floyd, then you're really scraping the barrel. So obviously, I think they'll be drafting one either way. They want a speed guy, but depth is definitely going to be an issue if they just let him walk and don't do too much else with the position.
So let's hit the final couple of topics really quickly. We saw the defense was just phenomenal again. Jesse Reynolds, one of our writers for the site, he wrote up a piece that will be going up on the site tomorrow about how Football Outsiders, using their advanced metrics, has the Cardinals as the number one overall defense in the league. So definitely, if you're listening to it, hit up the site and catch that article as it uses this. You can take a look at, some of the yardage numbers don't look good. They look good against the run, against the pass. They're kind of okay, and overall overall, they look great. Now, the quote was actually really good. Carson Palmer was asked about the Arizona defense, and he had a great soundbite saying, "Hey, we went up against the number one defense in the NFL, and I would take our defense over their defense." If you had to pick, Ben, would you take the Arizona defense or you take the Houston defense? And I'm going to say this: a healthy Houston defense, assuming Brian Cushing is back there again.
I was going to say, is this with or without Cushing? He's always injured or suspended or something. I would take Arizona. They don't have Houston doesn't have a whole lot of star power outside of, like, Watt and Cushing. You look at maybe Jonathan Joseph, but I take Peterson over Joseph, I think. So I believe the Cardinals match up pretty well position by position with them. And then you look at statistically, the Texans are the number one, at least by, the more basic kind of NFL.com metrics, but I think a lot of that has to do with their offense helping them a little bit more. Most of the time when Houston turns the ball over, it's going for 6 points, like right then and right there. It's scoring plays, it's pick sixes. So that doesn't really go against the defense, and then their offense is built to run and control the clock, which helps them out a little bit too. So I would go with Arizona. I think they have a tougher job, and I think they've been a lot more impressive for what they've been asked to do.
Seth, would you take Houston's healthy defense or the Arizona defense as it is?
I think probably the Arizona defense, but only because that comes with Todd Bowles, and there's a really great article written, I can't remember who wrote it, but that basically said if Wade Phillips is your defensive coordinator, you're never going to win a Super Bowl. So for that reason alone, I take the Cardinals defense.
not a bad. And I lean towards more what Ben said. That the if you look across the defense, you've got more consistent producing names. I'd take Patrick Peterson over Jonathan Joseph. I would take Darrell Washington, and I'd even take Darrell Washington, Carlos Danzi over Brian Cushing. I'm not sure. I don't think I could pick between J.J. Watt and Calais Campbell. Both of them are really, really good, and they're slightly different skills, but they're really good there. You look across the other parts. Do you go with – would you trade Tyrann Mathieu for anyone on the defense? I don't think so. So I like what they do schematically. I like their speed, and I like just the talent across the board on the Arizona defense. Last topic, and we'll deal with playoff chances. That right now, the Arizona Cardinals are 5-4, currently number 7 in playoff seeding. They're behind the San Francisco Giants. They have the Jacksonville Jaguars coming up. Definitely a winnable game they should win, and if they're going to be considered playoff, they have to win. They come back home against Indianapolis. They have away games against Tennessee and Philadelphia. Again, these are doable games. You've got the Rams at home. And then you still have the elephant in the room. Those are the last 2 weeks of the season. We have to go to Seattle, and you come back home in week 17 to host the 49ers in a potentially a game that will decide their playoff fate. Are they contenders? Are they pretenders? Or do we not know yet? Personally, as much as I'd like to say that they're contenders, they're in the mix. We really don't know. I can't say that we know they're pretenders or contenders yet because they still have to do. I mean, I said they have to go 3-1 in the next 4 games. They're well on their way to do that, but they still have to do it. And if they do that, and honestly, I think I want them to go 4-0 in this stretch to say that they're a contender. Otherwise, they're still, in my opinion, even if they lose Indianapolis, still kind of, we'll see. Seth, what do you say? Pretenders, contenders, or do you not know yet?
I mean, based on their schedule now and just the teams they're playing, you have to say contenders, with the caveat that, you know, unfortunately, the teams that they're chasing also have pretty easy schedules. So they're going to have to figure out a way to continue to win games that they're supposed to win, which is what playoff teams do, and then find a way to win, like you said, that Colts game, maybe even grab I won't say Seattle game, but maybe grab the San Francisco game.
Basically, the San Francisco game is going to make or break their season. I can't say that they even have a chance in Seattle. Who's going to beat Seattle in Seattle? That's insane.
Yeah, the game that could really make or break their season, obviously, is, you know, hopefully it'll be that San Francisco game. But I really think that the 3-game stretch coming up now after this week, which is Indy at home, which is, you know, Indianapolis is the most Jekyll and Hyde team in the NFL right now. They're either going to beat Seattle or they're going to get blown out, you know, by the Rams. And then they have to go to Philadelphia, who unfortunately throw the ball really well. And if there's one issue on the defense, it's defending the pass. And so that could be an interesting game. And then they have to come back and play a Rams team that even, you know, even recently kind of have had their number. And so that 3-game stretch really, really could, you know, define whether, you know, hopefully that San Francisco game matters. But I think, like I said, just based on how some of these teams have been injured, Tennessee, even St. Louis, and then, of course, Jacksonville, that's 3 games you should win, which puts you at 8. And at that point, you need to find a way to win 1 and basically go 1-2 in those other 3 games, and you can make it to, you know, have a chance in the make it in the playoffs.
Ben, do you say pretender, contender? Do we not know yet?
I'm voting for contenders as well. And it makes me so happy to say that. Probably one of the best things I can say about Arians is plays into what Seth was saying, is that the playoff teams beat the teams that they're supposed to, and the Cardinals have pretty much been able to do that this season, and maybe even going a little bit above and beyond that by beating Carolina and Detroit. You know, those guys are in the playoff hunt. I think they're ahead of the Cardinals right now in the chase as it is. So you look at Carolina, they just beat San Fran, and then the Cardinals obviously were able to hang in there against San Fran for the better part of that game that they played a couple of weeks ago, and then they so close to beating St. Louis at home, which is still a good team, obviously, when they're trouncing the Colts. They're still a threat even without, even without Sam Bradford, but honestly, they might be better now. you can bring that up with St. Louis fans if you want, but the thing with the Cardinals is, you know, as someone who's, we're awfully critical of the team, but it's because we want them to succeed, you know, and we're stuck with them every week, so, you know, the holes are blatantly obvious to us, but you look around the league and most of the teams, you know, especially the fringe playoff teams, have problems. They all have holes. There's something wrong with all these teams, you know. So the Cardinals have a defense, and if the offense can get it figured out, which they've maybe shown some signs that they're starting to do these last couple of weeks, then I definitely think they're a contender. Yeah.
It's wonderful. It's a great thing to hear. Contenders. Now, I'm going to add one thing. I like that Philadelphia game. And we'll put it with this one thing. I'm going to rubber stamp. I'm going to say book it. If Michael Vick starts the game for the Eagles, book it. The Cardinals are winning. They have got Michael Vick's number. Nick Foles, I don't know. They don't have much on him. But if we see the Arizona Cardinals facing a Philadelphia Eagles team led by Michael Vick, that is going into the win column. Arizona Cardinals fans, we've wrapped up another little more than an hour of Friends of the Birds Radio. Thank you for listening. If you listen to us live, we greatly appreciate. We love to hear from you on future shows. If you're listening to us via download, please make sure to find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio and subscribe and get those episodes downloaded automatically. On behalf of Seth and Ben, this is Jess Root, your host, and we are signing off. Good luck. We will be back on the air, hopefully, with a guest from SB Nation's Big Cat Country as we preview the game against the Jaguars this week. Hopefully we can get that interview set up and broadcast out to you Thursday night. But have a good night, everybody. Thanks for coming on, Seth and Ben.
Thanks, guys.
Have a good one. Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Revenge of the Birds. Keep the conversation going by visiting revengeofthebirds.com. Follow us on Twitter at Revenge of Birds. You can also find us on iTunes at facebook.com/Revenge of the Birds.
You know it's summer when all people want to talk about is the weather. How seasonable it is, especially for this time of year. How incredibly mild. How typical. How it's finally come around. And how actually, now that it is here, it's all just a bit too much. We don't mind it hot, but not this hot. You also know it's summer when you can grab yourself a frozen strawberry lemonade. Tangy iced lemon mixed with a sweet strawberry swirl. $1.99 from the McCafe Ice Range at McDonald's. Served until the 11th of October, subject to availability. Price and participation may vary.